for hosting this event and hosting such a wonderful event. Area 9 Archives doing this every year. In spite of what's going on this year, we're still doing it. I think it's absolutely wonderful and invaluable. I want to thank Jerry F, Jerry B, Judy B, Joan S, and Raul, all for speaking with us tonight or this afternoon. And yes, Richard. How are you, Richard?
Wow.
I'm all right. How you doing, Anthony?
I'm doing good. It's good to see you. I'm going to open up the questions here and we'll get to it. So thanks for talking with us this afternoon, Richard.
My pleasure.
So first I have to read this to you. I know you've probably heard this a couple times already this afternoon, but here we go. This tape is produced for the Mid-Southern California Area Archives and as such will not be reproduced for other uses. This tape will remain in the custody of the Mid-Southern California Area Archives. In the interest of anonymity, we ask that no last names be stated. And now, do I have your permission to tape this interview?
You do.
Okay, thank you so much. Now, it's my hope that you'll be as candid with us as possible today. And I gotta say, frankly, I'm amazed that you're alive. I've heard a bit of your story and wow. So let's get to it. Would you mind please stating your first name and sobriety date?
Richard W. And my sobriety date is September 14th, 1983, which means about 2 weeks ago, I celebrated my 37th year. And I find it interesting among this panel here with 37 years, I'm the newcomer. So.
Well, happy birthday.
Thank you.
Now, where did you get sober?
In Long Beach. I mean, it was a long journey, but when I ultimately stopped, I was in the Long Beach area. I didn't have a home, so I was a drifter, so I was in the Long Beach, North Orange County area, or this part of town.
Now, Richard, I've been sober 8 years, and I've been going to meetings for 9 years. Your story and your bottom, it was really, really shocking and moving for me to hear it when I first heard it. And I'm wondering if, you know, perhaps you can talk a little bit about your last days of alcoholism before you got sober.
Okay, I'll tell you about the day before I got sober, maybe just that 24-hour period. The day before I got sober, I gave up. I gave up any hope. I gave up any thought that I could ever be sober. I had been to detox 16 times. I'd been on the streets for 4.5 years. I'd been given 6 months to live, and I was down to the last 2 months of what was supposed to be my life. And I had 2 months to go, and I couldn't do the time. And so with all the desperation of a dying man, I decided to get myself dead. You know, in the big book, it says that we get to this point where we can't imagine life with alcohol and we can't imagine life without alcohol. And we will ultimately wish for the end. And we will at some point perhaps become willing to make the supreme sacrifice rather than try another day. And it's the point I got to. So the day before I got sober, I put a knife into the vein in my arm and I laid down to die. And, that's where alcoholism took me, you know, and I oftentimes say that when the big book talks about this disease being cunning, baffling, and powerful, I always think, what an understatement. You know, it's so much, it's fatal. It's if we have a fatal disease, and one way or another, it was going to take me out. I hope you can you hear that motorcycle racing by God? And I'm inside with all the windows closed trying to block out noise, but I don't know if it's going to do much good because of where I live. Anyway, somebody found me, scooped me up, rushed me to another hospital, stitched my arm up, kicked me out. They said, we don't keep your kind in this hospital. You have to leave now. And by the way, somebody was talking about Harvard General. You know, I was a frequent flyer at county hospitals, Long Beach General and Harvard General both. And you know, they like to keep you and study you, whereas the really nice hospitals, they just do this program that I call patch and release. You know, they, by law, they have to keep you from dying, but they don't have to keep you. All they have to do is patch you up and let you go. So anyway, I wound up getting stitched up, released. The next morning when I came to, I was furious that I was still alive. I got a bottle, which is what I did. And that became the day of my last day drinking. And it was just, you know, it was I don't have time to tell you the whole story, but it was a series of events. And for me, it had to do with, you know, acceptance of the fatal nature of my disease. It had to do with surrender to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'd been to many, many, many AA meetings and many facilities where AA came to visit. And then my third part of my triangle was hope. I got some hope by talking to a member of AA that night and stopped drinking the next day, and have stayed stopped ever since. So that's sort of where I was at the end.
Thank you for sharing with that with us, Richard. Now, I found it really interesting in your story. I heard you mention that you went to hundreds of meetings drunk.
Mm-hmm. I did.
Before you got sober.
I did.
Now, for me, it certainly wasn't that many, but I went to a lot of meetings drunk myself. What finally, you know, how did you manage to finally put together time sober?
Well, all had to do with those 2 days. It had to do with, you know, in between all, I kept being drunk, and then I would get to a point where I couldn't go on anymore. So I'd find another detox that would take me. And I thought if I could get 3 or 4 days in a detox, and I could get out and stay sober. Well, I got drunk the day I got out every time. But then as I was being drunk, you know, until I went to the next detox, I kept coming to AA. And my problem was, you know, the only place I thought the answers existed was in AA. So I kept coming back, but I couldn't stay sober long enough in the day to get to the meeting undrunk. And I don't have any problem with people coming to meetings drunk. I welcome them. I mean, where else are they supposed to go? And nobody ever denied me. I mean, I came to meetings drunk all the time. And my problem was that I was so drunk when I got to the meetings that there was too much booze between me and you, and between me and your message, and between me and your principles, and me and your steps, and me and your book, and me and everything of value, that none of it could penetrate, you know? So try hundreds of meetings and many detoxes. But when I finally got to that point of absolute unequivocal acceptance, surrender, and then was given some hope by this man, it was that turned the trigger. And the next day is the day I was able to stop. So I don't know if that answers your question, but for me, it was just the finality of the whole thing. It was either die or give AA one last try and just hope to God it worked. And, you know, luckily I was given the hope by this member of AA who talked to me. He talked to me and gave me hope.
Can you tell me a little bit about that, that gentleman that spoke to you?
Yeah, I can. told this story a few times. So that last day when I was drinking, you know, I mean, I got drunk all day. I went to a detox. I left the detox to finish the drunk off. I went through a second drunk of the day because I was just wanted to finish it off. If I was going to finish, I needed to be done. And at the end of the second drunk of the day, I called a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we didn't know each other, at least well. I had heard him speak at an AA meeting that I was at a couple years before that. And I was drunk when I was at the meeting, but I'd identified with his story. And I'd asked him for his phone number after the meeting. He'd given it to me. I'd never called him once, ever in 2 years, you know. But he saw me staggering in and out of meetings, so he knew who I was. And I called him around midnight at the end of that second drunk of the day. And this is a little bit contrary to what some people think. Some people think that it doesn't do much good to talk to a drunk when they're really drunk. And I'm here to tell you that I unequivocally disagree with that. I'll say that oftentimes it does no good, but in my case, it did all the good in the world, all the good, because that man talked to me that night for an hour in the middle of the night. He knew I was just drunk that never could get sober. And yet he did talk to me. He stayed up late at night and talked to me. And he said, tomorrow, don't try not to drink. And tomorrow night, I'll take you to AA when I get home from work. And you know, there's a dramatic story because he wound up calling me the next day to take me to a meeting. I'd gone over to this other drunk's house and he could call me there. And it turned out he talked to me for another hour, let me know that I mattered, and let me know that it mattered to him if I got sober, mattered to him if I lived or died. And he told me he loved me. And all he knows of me is that I'm just this drunk that just can never, ever get sober. And after about an hour of that conversation, I asked him if we were going to go to a meeting that night like he had suggested or said he was going to. And he told me he couldn't because his father had died that day in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And he had to make arrangements, pack his bags, and catch a plane to Fort Wayne to help his mother make the arrangements to bury his father. And that did it for me. You know, I mean, probably one of the most horrible days of his life, and he takes an hour out of that night to let me know I mattered, and I hung on to that while he was gone and stayed sober since. And, wow. And his name was Ted, by the way, and I love that man. He remained my sponsor my first 12 years of my sobriety, and then he moved out of state and I got a new sponsor.
Wow. That's amazing. So Ted, you said, became your first sponsor.
Right, immediately.
Immediately. So what sort of direction did he give you when you were very new?
Yeah, the most important thing he did for me, well, first of all, I didn't have a place to live and I didn't own a car and I didn't have any money. I was a derelict, you know. So first thing he did was agree to take me to a meeting every day for 30 days. And he picked me up wherever I was and he hauled me off to a meeting and he really took me to 30 different meetings. I thought it was a beautiful thing to do, you know, and I didn't know what he was doing at the time, but what he was doing was exposing me to the variety of meetings that existed kind of in the Long Beach, Seal Beach area. You know, he lived in Seal Beach, so he was really familiar with Seal Beach meetings, but he also did a lot of Long Beach meetings. And at the end of 30 days and basically 30 different meetings, he said, pick seven. And he says, go to a meeting today from now on. He didn't say 30 and 30 or 90 and 90. He said to go to every meeting every day from now on. I kind of taken him to heart ever since. I still go nowadays I do go every day with the way we're set up. But I did for a long, long time, a meeting a day. And the meetings by exposing me to so many meetings, I didn't get locked into any one place. Like I didn't do all my meetings at a specific club or a specific location. Basically what he was telling me is what I tell people now. I said, go where you fit. You know, if you walk into a room and you don't feel like you fit, you feel like there's antagonism, you don't feel the love, you know, whatever, you don't have to go there. We have hundreds and hundreds of meetings to pick from. And we did back then and we still do now. And so I picked a meeting a day. Actually, I wound up going to 8 meetings a week for my first year. And they were all based on the initial ones that he took me to. And I think that's the best thing he ever did for me, is like exposed me to the variety of meetings that existed in this area.
Absolutely. Now, I know a lot of people in Long Beach know you and they're familiar with what it is that you do during the daytime. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if maybe you can tell us a little bit about Easy Does It Bookstore and how that came to be. And what exactly that is.
Well, okay, I will. I by no means want to make it sound anything like a plug, because I don't like to mix those things. As a matter of fact, before I opened the store, I wrote I wrote to New York World Services and I basically asked for permission because I didn't know if I would be violating anything. But what had happened to me was when I was early on sober, there was a little shop in Huntington Beach called Elaine's, and Elaine's was a gift shop, like where tourists would go and buy postcards and shells and stuff. And old Elaine, she's long since passed away, but she was also one of us. And she, in the back of her little gift shop, she had some stuff where they had recovery stuff, you know, drunk junk, you know, the hidden away almost in the back corner. And I used to go there to buy it, you know, like if I had a friend that was going to take a chip, I might go down there and buy a chip or whatever, you know, to me, it was like something beyond our circle that made recovery seemed a little bit bigger than just what we do at meetings, you know, just going to talk to her. And when I would go out there to her store, she was friendly and she was happy and she was knowledgeable. And she seemed to welcome people when they came in, you know, just a really good vibe, you know. So I used to go out there kind of regularly. And then later on, she closed that store and opened a store in Fountain Valley, and then opened a third store. And I mean, one closed another one, opened another one. And I always went to her stores for stuff. And I always enjoyed her company. And, you know, this kind of this little outside the circle, you know, just a little bit more stuff. It's like going to a retreat, you know, it's a little bit different than a meeting, or going to a convention. It's a little bit different than just what we normally do. So to me, that felt like just something a little bit outside of the normal spectrum that we lived in. And so anyway, I you know, after I got sober, I got a job, which was great, because in I got a job for minimum wage, which was $3.35 an hour, and 1 hour I made more than the previous 4 years combined. So I was skyrocketing to financial success. Anyway, I got another job, and it wound up doing, I had good jobs, and I wound up having a lot of different kinds of successful little careers along the way. And the last business job I had, I was working for a consulting company, and then I splintered off from them, and I opened my own company. And after about 5 years, it started to go downhill because of some legislation in Sacramento. And so I really was at a point in my life where I had a taste of self-employment long enough that I realized that's kind of what I wanted to do. But I didn't know what, and I didn't know what I wanted to go into. And I explored a lot of ideas, and then I finally thought, I thought about Elaine and that store and how much I enjoyed going there. And she had passed away, and the store had fallen into somebody else's hands that wasn't like Elaine. And so I didn't feel like I was being disloyal to her. But anyway, so I thought about doing it, and I wrote a business plan and explored a lot of locations, and finally decided to do it, decided to open a store. I sought out help from somebody who's on one of these squares, and she advised me against it. I said, I'm going to do it anyway, you know, I'm a stubborn alcoholic. So, because what I wanted to do is I kind of wanted to stay working or doing something with us, but I didn't want to work as a therapist or a counselor. I didn't want to be in that kind of environment. I wanted to just do something a little lighter, you know, I thought would be funner. I thought it'd be nice to sit around all day and read books, which I haven't done yet while I'm at the store. And so I decided to do it. And so I opened it 23 and a half years ago, and still going now, you know, it's a store, not just for people in our program, but I have things in there for 24 different 12-step programs. So it's literally a 12-step store. It's not an AA store. It's not an N, you know, it's a 12-step store, or it's a store focusing on 12-step recovery. And like I said, initially I wrote to AA before I did it, because even though I knew other stores like this existed, I didn't know if they would give it their blessing, you know? And so anyway, I wrote to New York World Services and told them what I intended to do. And, you know, their opinion always is, we have no opinion. And if they say they have no opinion, that means it's okay with them. And I asked them for some advice about naming the store and pricing and other stuff. And they wrote me back a very nice letter and basically said, you know, we're free to do it. And so I did. And I've been doing it ever since.
Now, I've gotten to know you a little bit, as I frequent your store every now and then. And I think, you know, just about everybody in Long Beach AA knows Easy Does It Bookstore. When I was hearing your story, you said something really interesting, that it's not so much about the retail as it is meeting people and talking to people. And would you say that's true?
Well, you know, here's what I thought. And, you know, I thought that I would have, the structure would be a retail store, and it would be a retail store so that it could generate some income to pay for itself and hopefully pay me a little wage. So the structure would be retail. But I always thought, when I was sort of planning this and thinking about it, that it would probably take on more of a life of its own. I always use those terms, and it would go in whatever direction the universe wanted it to go in. And I didn't know what that would be. Maybe it would just be a straight ahead, you know, 12-step recovery store, and that's it. You know, you walk in, buy stuff, and walk out. And da, da, da. And it's just turned out to be the opposite. You know, somebody, about 20 years ago, a reporter came in, probably Jerry would have even known him. But anyway, he was a reporter for the Press Telegram. He wanted to do a story about the store. And before I would agree to it, he came in the store three different times. I gave him three different lectures on anonymity and what he was allowed and not allowed to say in an article. I sent him away with a 12 and 12 and all the parts highlighted that indicated what he couldn't write or couldn't do. Because once they write it, you don't get to read it. You know, you don't get to edit it. But anyway, he did it and he sat in the store for three different occasions for a couple hours. He just sat in the back room and he watched what happened and he talked to people, you know, just sort of casually. And one of the remarks he made in his article was, there are few quick purchases made in this store. And he went on to talk about how when people come in, they come in and they're going to be there a while. And it's not because necessarily just because they're shopping. It's because there's a certain atmosphere in there, I think, that's been created by us, you know, by partially by me, partially by people who have helped out in there, partially by people who come there and are there a lot. There's just a certain atmosphere that I hope and I think has been very welcoming to people. And so people come and they meet one another and they talk to me and they talk to each other and they sit in the back and they read a book or they sit in the back. I used to have a little couch in the back and I don't know how many times people have come back there and sat in the back and cried. And I don't, you know, what they were crying about really isn't my business unless they make it my business. But sometimes, you know, they're very upset about something in their personal life or something's happening. They just needed a place to go where they could be safe and they could be heard. And I think it's provided that for lots and lots of people over the years. You know, I had a guy in there yesterday, sober 2 days, you know, and so before he leaves, he's gonna have a big book, whether he has money or not, and he's gonna have a directory, whether they're accurate or not these days because of COVID. But and they're gonna feel like they're welcome to come back, and they're gonna be told about meetings, and they're gonna be told about how AA works, and they're gonna be felt. Hopefully, when they leave, they're gonna have felt like they mattered. They're gonna feel like they've experienced love, and it seems to, you know, I guess if there's proof in the pudding, it's that, you know, oftentimes those people come back in, and you know, they'll say hi, they'll say, oh, thanks for the chip you gave me 18 years ago or whatever, you know. And so anyway, it has sort of taken on that kind of atmosphere, and I kind of anticipated that and hoped for that at the beginning, but I didn't know if it would turn out that way, but it has. So I think it's been hopefully it's been a benefit to people.
I think that's absolutely amazing. Now I know you used to employ a sponsee of mine at your store, which you might remember. Do you often employ newcomers? You know,
well, I don't really employ anybody. what I oftentimes get is volunteers, and I have arrangements with, you know, some of the local recovery facilities, and recovery facilities oftentimes want people once they get to a certain stage of their whatever that program they're in is, then they want them to become productive, and they either want them to get jobs, or if they can't get a job, they want them, you know, well, if you can't get a job, then go volunteer. And sometimes they'll say, you can either volunteer at, you know, at this hospice place or Meals and Wheels, or excuse me 1 second, I don't know how to turn that off. Or you can go out and volunteer down at Richard's store. So some of the people wind up at my store. Yeah. By the way, I've got to just put this out there just for a second, because I one thing I abhor at AA meetings is people with telephones. I abhor that. And especially if they're using them or looking at them. In my case, 2 days ago, a very close friend of mine died. And he didn't have any family, and I'm sort of the point person in terms of things like lawyers and coroners and funeral homes, and that was the lawyer. So
I'm sorry to hear that, Richard.
Well, yeah. Anyway, what happens with us does not life happens. I forgot where we were. Sorry about that.
No, that's quite all right. Now, I had heard you in the speak that I had heard of you talk about a lot of interesting stories of different people that have come through your store. And I promise we'll stop talking about your store eventually.
Please.
So, but, you know, there were some really interesting things that you said, though, you know. And I'm wondering if maybe you can share us some of the most memorable AA-related experiences that have happened, mm-hmm. you know, through your, you've had the store for 23 years. So I'm sure yeah. you've been interesting stuff that's happened.
There has been. I don't know how many will just pop into my head, but, you know, I shared this at another memorial a few weeks ago. A woman had come in the store from, she had come out here from Sweden. Actually, what happened was she was a sober person in Sweden. She went to a convention, an AA convention in her hometown in Sweden. She met an American guy who showed up at the convention, and he said, if you ever come to Southern California, you have a place to stay, no strings attached. And anyway, she wound up going there to the guy's house. He lived in Long Beach, and there were going to be strings attached. So she was really, really upset. She was walking down Broadway in tears because she didn't know where to turn, where to go next, because she knew she couldn't stay at this guy's house. And she sees a sign that says, easy does it. And she goes, ah, this could be my people, you know. And she came into the store, and it became her safe place. And, you know, and she wound up, you know, getting other living arrangements, and she bought a little car so she could travel around. And then after about 2 months, she was going to go back to Sweden, and she was going to give the car back to this place where she bought it, and they were going to try and sell it for her, but the money was going to come to me and then get to her. I don't know what it was, but anyway, I was sort of involved in it. And she came in the store to make those arrangements about the hopefully selling her car someday. And this other one of us was in there, this woman who just passed away, Liz T, I'll say. And she was in the store when this girl was going on about having to dispose of this car. And she just looks at her and says, well, what kind of car is it? And she, I don't know, whatever it was. She tells her, and she says, where is it? And the lady points outside. They went out and looked at it, and they walked back inside, and Liz wrote her a check and bought it on the spot. So that happened. Then another time I had a couple come in. They came in and they said they're celebrating their 1 year wedding anniversary. I said, oh yeah, really? I said, where'd you guys meet? And they said, here. They had met in the store a couple of years before that. And I mean, that's where they met. And they eventually ran off and got married, and they're still married. And I don't know, you know, I've just had every imaginable kind of humanoid has walked in that store, you know. I mean, every imaginable type, rock and roll stars, you know, and just everybody. They all, people tend to just, people that need our stuff tend to come in there. I caught me off guard there. I would have had more store stories, but I didn't know we were going to be talking about the store so much.
Well, yeah, let's move on then, you know. You know, I want to go back maybe to your early few years of sobriety. You've been sober 37 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to newcomers, that sounds impossible.
Yeah.
Yeah, and certainly for me, that's a long time. What sort of things did you do for service when you were a newcomer?
Well, here's the deal. So I'm in all these detoxes. And I'm gonna, because my whole, this is going to lead to your question, but the first detox program thing I ever went into was Long Beach General Hospital. It's county facilities. It's all men, all indigents. You know, we are a low bottom group of, you know, indigent drunks, and we're in this detox, and then they allowed you to stay for this 30-day program with, you know, but it's all county, you know, it's all derelicts, you know, it's a rough crowd. And we were in there about, I was in there 4 or 5 days, and they came into the little detox area and they announced, all right, everybody go, you know, come out to the sun room, which is a room that had a window. So that became the sun room. And they said, because you're going to have now an AA panel is going to come in and talk. And I didn't know what a panel was. I didn't even know what AA was. You know, it was my first exposure ever, was in that facility. And so we go into this little room. There's probably about eight of us guys and, you know, all sorts of disarray. And in walked three women. And these three women were well-dressed, well-kempt, pretty, different ages, like 20, 40, and 60, articulate, friendly, not intimidated by the looks of us. And they sat down and they told us their stories. And I've said this 1,000 times, I didn't relate to any of their stories, none. I was 0-for-3 on their stories, but I was 3 out of 3 on how much respect I had for these ladies for coming in to do that. I thought, my God, these women are coming into a place filled with a bunch of guys like us that had given up their time in the middle of a day to tell us their stories and tell us about Alcoholics Anonymous. I was so impressed with what they did. Not with their stories, just what the fact that they came in and did that. And then later, you know, more panels came in when I was in the rehab part of the program. And so, you know, 15 more detoxes later, in all of those places, people from AA came in and they talked to us, you know, and they did panels in these places. They did panels at Reagan, they did panels at the Men's 12-Step House and the Charlie Street and Wayne Fanning Detox and all these places I'd been in. And every time I was in one of those places listening to these people, I thought, when I get out of here this time, I'm staying sober. And when I get sober and stay sober for a little while, I want to come back to these places and be on the other side of the table. I want to be one of them instead of one of me, you know? And so, and my problem was, of course, I couldn't stay sober one day. So every time I got out, I got drunk until, you know, the very, very end. So I wasn't able to do it. So when I finally got sober, that was my mission. My mission was, I want to do HNI stuff. I want to go back to those places. And I made a commitment to go back and do panels at every place that I had been in and more, you know, and I wound up doing that. And I wound up taking panels at places for anywhere from 1 year to my last one I gave up, I'd kept for 25 years. And I gave it up in the spirit of rotation, you know what I mean? So like the backbone of my service program, it was always HNI stuff because it was so impressive to me when I was trying to get sober early on. But I couldn't do any panels at first because I asked these people, I said, how long do you have to be sober before you can do these panels? And they told me 6 months. Nowadays you go on a panel with somebody if you have a week, you know, but back then they said 6 months. And I don't know if that was really policy or if they just thought I needed a little more fine tuning before they were going to turn me loose on these people. I don't know. But anyway, so for 6 months, I couldn't do those things. So what else was I going to do? Well, one of the very first meetings that my sponsor took me to was the East Bay Group, which is at the time was a huge speaker meeting on 7th Street at the Bruin Den, probably 200, 250 people. And he takes me to that meeting and I'm scared to death because it's the biggest meeting I've ever seen. And he takes me there really early. And I look around and my sponsor said, well, Richard, you need to learn to start to give back. You need to start being of service. And I said, what can I do, Ted? I'm like 3 days sober. I don't know anything. I can't do anything. And he pointed down because you walked in at this little level and the seating was down below. He pointed down there and he says, well, see that guy down there setting up chairs? I said, yeah. He says, go help him. And that started it, you know, because when I finished setting up the chairs with that guy, I felt a little bit more like I belonged in AA. And all I did was set up some chairs and put out some ashtrays. And all of a sudden I wasn't just a guy attending a meeting. I was participating, you know, I was doing something. It didn't matter what, just something. I was doing something. And I kind of got, you know, I've been kind of a service junkie ever since. You know, we're lucky in AA because we have so many different kinds of service opportunities, you know, like people that put this on, they might be more involved with GSR and archive and our service structure, you know, but there's, you know, there's sponsorship, there's HNI, there's group service commitments. There's so much we can do. But I found out back then that any little bit that I could do made me feel a little bit more part of this outfit. And and it's kept me in good stead ever since. So anyway, that was that kind of stuff. And I did a lot of other little things. You know, I answered phones for central office for a while. I have some crazy stories about that. And I was GSR, I was HASC rep, and, you know, kind of did a lot of little short-term things, but my long-term thing was always H&I.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Again, going back to the fact that you've been sober for 37 years, and this is a question that I always like to ask people because it's happened to me before. How do you keep your sobriety fresh? You know, how do you prevent yourself from growing stagnant in AA?
I have to like filter everything through today, you know, today with COVID and everything's different. You know, I think back to the first 36 and a half years of my sobriety when before pre-COVID, you know, because now everything looks different, acts different, is different. I think probably the key to me is two things. One is always, I've always just stayed in the middle of AA, like in the middle of the herd. And, you know, there's a guy at my beach meeting on Sunday mornings, and he always says, stay in the middle of the school of fish, because he's a fisherman, you know. But, you know, if you're in the middle of the pack, you're less likely to get picked off on the edges. And so I've always stayed in the middle. And it doesn't mean I'm always doing everything for everybody. It just means I'm in the middle of it all. I don't let myself get outside of what's worked for me for these years, you know. And the other thing is just consistency. I'm just consistent. I don't, you know, I don't know how many times I've heard about people that say, oh yeah, I quit going to AA for, you know, a month or a year or this or that, and some stayed sober and some didn't. But I've never stopped coming. I just come regularly. I still do as much service as I've ever done. You know, I'm in a kind of a unique situation because I'm always encountering new people. You know, I do a lot of, you know, talking out there, and people approach me afterwards. And so I get a lot of interaction with new people. And then also at my work, I get a lot of interaction with new people. And as long as there's new people around me, it stays fresh because I'm constantly being reminded of, you know, what it used to be like for me and what it would still be like for me if I drift away. And so I think being in the middle and staying consistent is probably the things that keeps me connected, as well as just doing what we do. You know, I still do the same things today that I did 37 years ago. I guess I'm just, you know, too afraid to go away. I'm afraid that if I go away and I wind up drunk, I'll just be a dead man. And that's just how that'll play out. I know that. And so sometimes fear is a good motivator. And it is for me. I mean, not that I walk around in fear about that. I just know that the closer I stay to you, the less likely I am to leave you. And as long as I'm near you, I'm near new people, and the people who are new to me and the people that I currently sponsor who keep me on my toes, one of which I'm looking at right now. I just got a smile out of them. You know, it keeps it all, it always keeps it fresh for me.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Richard. Mm-hmm. Now, I think we have probably about 3 or 4 minutes left here. So I want to give you the chance now, anything that you would like to say, any lasting wisdom to a newcomer or to maybe somebody with time sober that's suffering in AA, having a hard time, what would you say to that person?
Well, I don't know. If they're new, I have this little spiel for new people because I don't want to forget it. And if I repeat it often enough, I'm less likely to forget it. And for people that are reasonably new, and these are things that I learned when I was pre-new and I was still going in and out of all those places. But I learned to do 6 things. And so this looks like a pretty mature group out here that I'm looking at on my Hollywood squares anyway, but for anybody that might be reasonably new, I always tell them to go to a meeting every day because I think it's crucial. And Well, that's crucial for me. I tell them to get a sponsor and as quickly as possible. In my case, I got a sponsor on my first day or the day before my first day, and it was life-saving for me. I mean, just to feel like I was cared about. Oops, are you still there? I'm just losing my battery right now. Anyway, I also tell them to get to a meeting every day, get a sponsor, study the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, you can look behind me here, 500 books on alcoholism behind me, and the book that I always go to, my go-to book, is the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I always suggest they get busy working the 12 steps as quickly as possible. They don't need to wait around. I know I did my fourth step second step happened to me at 2 months. Third step happened to me. I didn't have to take them. They happened to me. Thank you, God. And I did my fourth step at 6 months, fifth step the 2 days later, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, just kind of get with it with the steps. Tell them to be open-minded about spiritual matters and remain that way. I'm still open-minded about spiritual stuff. I don't think I've found the answers yet. And then I suggest they get busy, you know, and get busy helping other people in whatever respect that looks like, you know, just start to get of service. And those six things that I learned in 1981, actually, not even, I didn't get sober till 83, work for me today. I do those same six things today. And that's the nice thing about AA. We don't have to reinvent anything around here. You know, people do a lot of things or repackage things or redescribe things in a lot of different ways, but the basics of this program are pretty simple. Yeah, not necessarily easy, we always hear, but pretty simple. And that's what I would tell anybody reasonably new, is to keep doing those things. And if they're finding areas where they're falling short, double up. That's about it.
Richard, thank you so much. Thank you so much for taking the time to share with us this afternoon.
You're welcome.
Yeah, it's good to see you as well.
You too.
So stop by the store soon.